Hello, I'm Brian.
I'm Caroline.
And this is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
Podcast.
And that third voice was our security editor, Alex Scroxton, who joins us today. Welcome back to the podcast. No Claire again today, but she will be back. So good weeks, guys. Second week of working from home.
Mm-hmm. We're in lockdown now, so it's all got a bit more intense, hasn't it? So yes, but yeah, second week, still hanging in there, still surviving. So
I've actually had a lovely week because I was in proper self-isolation for a week and was allowed out for the first time on Wednesday. So I've been enjoying my non-freedom on my government-mandated 1 hour daily exercise.
I've not been making that at all. I think we were talking about this, weren't we? Yeah, I'm hoping to maybe cycle into Oxford City Centre at the weekend, which will be interesting because there won't be that many people around. It should be nice to behold, as long as I don't get stopped by the police and thrown off my bike.
I went out yesterday and I actually had to make a run for medicines, as they have said we're allowed to do. So I walked down to the chemist and there was police patrolling our village high street. They weren't questioning anybody because we were all in a very orderly queue for the chemist. But yeah, they obviously are, you know, taking it very seriously, making sure people are only going out as and when they should be. They were peering into the windows of different shops, I think, also just to make sure they're closed as well. So yeah, it's all very, very, very serious. But that was my first time out since last Saturday. So it's quite marked, the difference just in atmosphere, everything really, just since the last time I was out and about.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see the city centre. It's normally absolutely packed with folk, tourists and all sorts of people. So top line on the podcast today, mostly corona. Caroline, you're going to talk about Rishi Sunak's latest package.
Oh, yes, I am. I'm going to talk about his package. Oh, dear. He's announced a package of support for self-employed, which we talked a little bit about on last week's podcast, just that, you know, there was a lot of anticipation around that. So, yes, yeah, so that's been announced now. So I'll talk you through just some of the reaction that's come in response to that since it was announced.
So more on that in a little bit. Alex, in terms of the UK CW team, you are our China expert.
Apparently, this has fallen to me over many years of writing about Huawei in my previous life as networking and comms editor. Now switched over to security as well.
Yeah, so also a big China-related area, security. But you're going to lead us off on how China and Southeast Asia more generally have approach the crisis in comparison with us.
Yes, and we were talking about this just the other day in terms of how they seem to have flattened the so-called curve quite successfully ahead of us, to the extent that there was a day earlier this week where there were no new community transmissions of the coronavirus in Wuhan. Other countries like Taiwan, South Korea, and Hong Kong and Singapore all seem to be showing that there's a path out the other side of this, and that they have really been able to address this in a much more effective way than countries that are now being hardest hit, Italy, Spain, the US being the big three, Britain to some extent as well, although our casualty toll is not as large as either of as any of those other places.
We'll go into that in a little bit more detail in a bit. I'm going to talk about the general use of data to govern societies apropos a very nice Stephen Matheson feature in CW on that topic. But we're going to start, Caroline, with you and the Chancellor. IT contractors are raging with Rishi, is that right?
Yeah, that's pretty much the what it boils down to. This was announced yesterday, so it's been quite a rush this morning trying to get the story up, just make sure our understanding on it is, you know, what we think it is. So it's been a lot going on this morning. I've been very busy before I ran onto the podcast. Yeah, so as I mentioned at the start of the podcast, we talked a little bit about last week about how the self-employed were feeling a little bit ignored and neglected by the measures that the government has introduced today in order to shore up the economy during the coronavirus pandemic. So at the time, you know, they were chomping at the bit to find out sort of what kind of support would be open to them, as it does seem like at the moment that a lot of temporary workers and freelancers have been among the first to be cut loose by organisations, you know, that are dealing with, you know, the downturn caused by the coronavirus outbreak. So yesterday evening, during the daily, the briefing the government's doing at the moment, the government showed its hand with what its plans were. And they basically to support individuals, self-employed, sole traders. And yeah, like you say, the IT contractors are pretty much raging over what's been announced. Yeah, like I say, there's been so much sort of anticipation on this. So you were kind of hoping it would be good news for people. But before we dig into that too much, we'll, you know, talk about what actually got announced. So yesterday, Rishi, he made a promise basically that we're going to pay self-employed people who earn up to £50,000 a year a maximum of £2,500 a month for at least the next 3 months. That might get extended, though, obviously, depending on how the pandemic pans out over the next few months. That is if their ability to earn an income has been adversely affected by coronavirus. That is going to be made possible through the provision of a taxable grant that's going to be worth up to 80% of the average monthly profit self-employed people have banked over the last 3 years. So it's there is a little bit of sort of digging into the detail on that, because there are obviously everybody's self-employed sort of status is slightly different. You know, some people might not have, you know, might not have been self-employed for 3 years so far, yeah, and things like that. So he did announce that, oh, you know, that they will take situations like that into an account. There's also people who haven't been self-employed like that long who you're not going to be able to access any of this support as well. But yeah, so the government said that this is all going to be put in place now, but due to the various sort of verification checks, making sure that people who are trying to apply for this support are actually eligible for it, you know, fraudsters being what they are, you know, it is going to take a little while for the first payments to be made available to people. So they've said, you know, HMRC are going to get in touch with people and say whether or not you're eligible for this support, and they're going to be doing all the paperwork behind it. But it's looking likely that the first payments from this scheme for self-employed people aren't going to come out until early June. Freelancers, self-employed people are among the people who have been cut loose first by organisations. That's quite a long time to wait for the money. So in the interim, they've been advised to apply for business interruption loans, keep themselves ticking over, but also to consider applying for universal credit. The rules on that in terms of access to universal credit but for self-employed people been opened up, been opened up a lot wider as a result of this. So they've been told, you know, there are things you can do, tide you over, but universal credit, you know, the first payment on that is quite famously only comes in after 5 weeks. So again, that's going to be a long time to wait. And as we had a story this week by our boss, Brian Glick, on universal credit, just showing that the online applications for that are creaking at the moment, just with the surge of people trying to apply for universal credit who've been adversely affected by coronavirus. So he was saying his report this week was that people trying to submit applications, you know, like I said, a lot of it has come down to just the traffic and the load of people trying to access universal credit website. But also there's been other bottlenecks caused by this system, which we've documented quite a lot on Computer Weekly Verify, the system that the government uses to verify that people who, you know, we are who we say we are when we go to pay for you know, car tax and whatever else. But yeah, there's been issues with that that has all had knock-on effects. And there's been, Brian was tracking it on Twitter, and it was, some of the numbers are just, they're a bit like the Ocado story last week. We were saying people like 20,000, number 20,000 in the queue. So it's an anecdote in his story, actually. Someone saying, oh, I put through my application, then went to bed. And then when I came down in the morning, it finally loaded up, like for verify, basically, because that, it, like I say, it's just the sheer number of people trying to get onto these systems. So everything is creaking. So yeah, that's been quite interesting. The thing that has caused quite a lot of upset among IT contractors on all this is the fact that the self-employed support that the government's announced, they're not allowed to access. Like I say, it's only accessible to sole traders, but if you're a limited company contractor, which is what a lot of IT contractors operate as, you're not entitled to any of the self-employed support. Because although they kind of consider themselves to be self-employed, technically they're employees of their own companies because they're operating limited companies and stuff like that. So their options, they've been told, is that they can apply for, this was something that was announced last week, which is the coronavirus job retention scheme fund. But there's a little bit of contention about how much money or sort of, you know, how much they would be able to access, how much financial support they'd be able to access through that scheme. So yeah, so they're not very happy. Even before coronavirus, IT contractors, a lot of them have lost work who are limited company contractors, because in the roll up to the IR35 reforms coming in, a lot of companies said, oh, in order to be compliant with the IR35 reforms, we're just going to get rid of our limited company contractors. It's just too problematic keeping them on our workforce. So a lot of limited company contractors have lost jobs or have moved jobs or have just entered the job market. But with this plan that, okay, well, it's fine, we'll leave the job we've got at the minute, but once the IR35 reforms, all the dust settles on that, the job market will rebound in a couple of months and we'll be able to find work again. But obviously coronavirus has happened now and lots of the job opportunities people were hoping would open up have just not emerged, and they probably won't for a while now. So they're all feeling the pinch quite a bit. Like, so I've heard from quite a lot of angry people since the announcements were made last night. So the Association of Independent Professionals and Self-Employed, IPSI, have said that, you know, they welcome the measures that the government's introduced. They've described it as a historic lifeline of financial aid for the self-employed, but they've acknowledged that there are gaps in its coverage, you know, where limited company contractors are concerned. So they've said they're going to plug away and sort of campaign for, you know, more support for limited company contractors. But in the interim, I don't really know, I said, what those people who are caught up in the IR35 stuff and coronavirus, people who aren't in work at the moment, what exactly they are going to do. Like I say, they can access the coronavirus job retention fund, and I'm guessing they might be eligible as well for universal credit. I'm not 100% sure on that, but yeah, it does seem quite a worrying time for all of them. So again, like I said, a lot of the people we speak to on all this have been quite, you know, they've been very anxious about hearing what provisions the government will be putting in for them, and yeah, I think they're very disappointed with what's come out so far.
A lot of very, very upset and quite distressed people calling into radio program I was listening before we began recording today. So my heart goes out to a lot of them. It's a horrible situation to be in.
And also, as well, I know we talk about this a lot on the podcast, but obviously you've got the loan charge story as well, which we're tracking at the moment. So you've got IT contractors as well on the other side of it, in some aspects, thousands of them who are out of work at the minute, can't find work, and are still facing having to pay these sort of six-figure sums of money to HMRC relating to tax to work they did sort of over a 10-year period as well. So it's you know, a lot of them are sort of feeling the squeeze on all of this at the moment. So I did kind of hope that maybe there would be something announced, that maybe the government would maybe put like a freeze or something on the loan charge side of things. Like, they have deferred the IR35 reforms, but no, okay. there doesn't seem to be anything incoming on that at the moment. But yeah, you just would kind of hope that it would take some of the pressure off that people are feeling at the moment, but that doesn't seem to be the case.
I think there is some consensus that the Chancellor is actually, you know, seems to be quite kind of cool and straightforward, and you know, and this package, although it's clearly suboptimal, is all about helping people through the crisis. But in China, they've allegedly beaten the virus, and their
life seems to be returning to normal.
Life seems to be returning to normal. I think we had a bit of a chat in our own Skype group yesterday about how China and how East Asia has approached the crisis. And this was provoked by, it was a text that Sebastian Klovig-Skelton, one of our reporters, got from one of his mates. And it was a text following on from the government's official text. And the second text said, basically, you've left the house, mate, 3 or 4 times, and so therefore you're going to be fined for this. And I did wonder, well, could they actually do that in China, and have they been doing that? And I think that's when I reached out to you, Alex, and asked you what, you know, the scale and scope and so on of the surveillance operation has been.
Obviously, as we have discussed before, China's state surveillance apparatus is fantastic is kind of the wrong word, but it's certainly fit for purpose if mass surveillance is your game. It's obviously very easy to track a mobile phone moving around an area as it moves from base station to base station. That would be information that I'm sure the Chinese government would have no difficulty in getting out of an operator that doesn't directly own the masts and the network infrastructure itself.
There's a question of culture, isn't there?
Yeah, and the idea that surveillance and the kind of surveillance that is necessary and the data collection that is necessary to really crack down on the virus in the effective way that that countries in the Far East have done is to some extent dependent on the local culture, by which I mean that Chinese culture is much more collective. I don't mean communist, but sort of collective in terms of working towards the common good. Everyone sees themselves as having a role in a society. And that's something that I think we in the West maybe like to think we did once upon a time, but have certainly don't at the minute. We're a much more individualistic culture, and we rely on policing by consent, for example, is the buzzword that the government likes to use, that we are policed and orderly because we consent to be to be policed. That's not quite the same, certainly not the same in China. Other Far Eastern countries are more liberal, of course.
Not just China, seems to have been reasonably, well, successful. I have to take their word for it at this point. There's also South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, they all seem to have...
They're all beating it very well, aren't they?
...quickly and locked down much more quickly than we did.
Well, as our APAC editor, Aaron Tan, was telling us a few weeks ago, again, over the Computer Weekly team group chat. And I think this was the day that people in Britain really started to notice the coronavirus, being mid-February, probably. And at that point, Singapore was already, locking people down, putting temperature sensors at the entrances to all public buildings, telling people to stay home for 2 weeks, more than a month before we did. And they've done extensive contact tracing as well, working out, who's seen who was in that particular carriage on the Singapore Metro, for example, and contacting and quarantining relevant people.
I was going to say, it's really interesting looking, because I had a look back over that part of the chat before we came on the podcast. Uh-huh. And it's amazing actually how much, as Alex alluded to there, that things have changed. Like, we're all sort of asking Aaron questions, like, sort of, oh my God, like, is it true self-quarantining's a thing? Oh my God, so you got to stay in your house? I can't even believe that. And you're like, yeah, we're all doing it now. It's just how quickly all, like, everything has moved on, and that it's really, really spooky. We were actually making jokes there about, apparently there's going to be toilet roll shortages. Now we're actually living in them.
I was going to say that. Yeah. He mentioned toilet roll, didn't he? That people were panic buying it in Singapore supermarkets. Yeah. Really? Yeah. That would never happen here. So how I wish I'd wish I'd listened. Yeah. One thing that we did also mention was China's social credit scheme. And I thought this worth mentioning, because whilst researching to come on the podcast today, I found a very interesting article on Wired, Brian. And this harks back to previous conversations that we've had on this topic. Chinese government is bringing in a social credit scheme where, good actions are rewarded, bad actions are shamed, and this is all monitored and controlled digitally. And the article on Wired that I've read is talking about people being blacklisted, publicly shamed on websites for fudging or failing to disclose that they traveled to Wuhan. Been particularly happening in the city of Hangzhou, which is near quite close to Shanghai, is actually where Alibaba is based. And Hangzhou has been a pilot city for the social credit scheme, and they've a number of people living there were called out, and apparently after their year of public shaming is done, will have to sign documents promising never to lie about their travel arrangements again and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I was listening to the Guardians Today in Focus podcast today. This is Friday 27th. Their Beijing correspondent, Lily Keo, she was being kind of quizzed about aspects of the lockdown and so on. It's quite a lot of interesting detail there. I mean, so the lockdown wasn't over the entirety of the country. But one thing that they did that we've not really been doing, which I thought was quite interesting, is that they do quarantine people. So if you have someone who's got the virus in a household, you take them out of the household and put them in a school or a hotel or something like that. So that they had that going on as a practice. And then they had this app, which refers back to similar to what you were saying there, Alex, where I'm sure you've got better detail on this than I have. It's either green, amber, or red. So you have to download the app. And if it turns green, you're fine. If you've been out and abouting, they'll know that, so it's amber. If you've been out and abouting a lot, then it goes green. So they have been controlling the population using that app, very, very simply, green, amber, green. And one of the things about that is, well, I mean, if my phone has turned red, the app, how do I know why? This transparency issue has been a big problem on the ground as well. And we tend to think that maybe they're just very compliant, but actually people have been very, very angry in China, especially about the initial cover-ups and things like that. So it's not like it's a placid population that just does what it's told.
No, by no means. You don't hear half of the we don't hear half in the West of the protests and anger that can happen in China.
Yeah, so that's I thought that was interesting too. But it does seem like life is regaining some normalcy, although quite a lot of worry about maybe a second outbreak. But now they're of course the Chinese are sending ventilators to Italy and things like that. I don't know if we're getting any of their ventilators, but they are, and they're. Some of their soft power will increase, presumably, as a consequence of them acting as the good guys on this.
Well, if Dyson is making our ventilators, then one assumes they will come from Malaysia, which is where they've famously relocated their factory.
But I suppose that fundamental thing about if you've got a spectrum in a society that's more individualistic towards being more communal, then it's very dangerous to generalise about these things, but it would seem that China and Taiwan and Singapore and South Korea and so on are more towards the communal end of the spectrum, and we're more towards the individualistic side of the spectrum.
I think there is truth in it, and it is obviously, to reiterate Brian's words, it's very important not to generalize and get ahead of oneself here, but Chinese history certainly shows that, and it's shown in how effective China has been as a global power. We don't think of China as a great global power, but for 2,000 years, it was the only game in town. It was they see in China the past couple of centuries as a blip.
And just the sheer, as we've said in the podcast, just the sheer volume and the size of the population, 1.2 billion people, and so on. And of course, the other implication of this from a technology point of view is that in terms of artificial intelligence and how that will develop in the future, having a more communalistically minded population is a big advantage, because it means that technology adoption is more rapid, that people are more willing to maybe share healthcare data. That's a big, big area for the development of AI systems.
These things do matter. You don't have technology without it, being a part of the society in which it exists. The two things are intrinsically linked. We may have forgotten that to some extent.
I mean, the COVID-19 coronavirus crisis has brought to the fore lots and lots of questions. But one of those is about data. It's about governing by data, using data, is that a good or a bad thing? We published this week on Computer Weekly a nice piece, I think, by Stephen Matheson, which I entitled Governing by Data, Limits and Opportunities. Now, when I sat down with Stephen to commission this, conjured up the figure of Dominic Cummings. Sorry, Justin. Because he's very into the whole concept of governing by data and using data analytics to govern a society. That's one of his big drivers. And what we wanted to do was kind of confect a piece that wouldn't mention Dominic Cummings, but would look at the whole notion, the concept of governing by data and just probe it a little bit. Anyway, it's a good piece. Stephen covers a lot of ground. He goes from Estonia to Essex. In fact, a big part of the piece is an extended case study that's centered on basically improving educational outcomes in Basildon, a thing called, I think it's the Essex Center for Data Analytics or Analytics, something like that. Anyway, people can read the piece and get the kind of detail on that. That was all about kids being ready for school. You know, the whole, I think we all, you know, it's quite well known that your life chances are really determined by 4 or 5 at the most in terms of how successful you're going to be in life. And so some of the analytics has been used to improve readiness for school children for school in a place called Vange. I don't even know if that's how you pronounce it, but it's in the borough of Basildon. Again, worth looking at the piece for the detail of that. Some nice quotes in Stephen's piece. Gavin Freegard from the Institute for Government really kind of poo-pooed data-driven as a term and said it's much better to think of being data-informed.
Ooh.
Seems like quite a facile thing to say, but if you stop and think about it, well, yeah, that is how it should be. It should be informed by data, especially when it comes to, because there's a difference between customers and citizens. I mean, as citizens, we live quite complex lives, and it's hard to reduce the complexity of those lives just to numbers. Yeah, so the kind of complexity of the lives of citizens is something that maybe is a little bit beyond just doing cold hard data analytics. And there's quite a nice quote from one of Stephen's sources. It's about healthcare and about data in healthcare. And he says, the NHS needs to stop looking for non-existent average patients and start considering the wide range of health interactions people experience rather than just individual courses of treatment, which I thought was kind of encapsulated that really well. Now, does he mention the coronavirus, I hear you ask? Not really. There is passing reference to Chris Whitty, but of course healthcare is a very data-informed, to use that term, kind of area. And it's a nice piece, but Stephen also makes the point that quite often politics will always trump data, or not always, but quite often will trump data. It gives the example of alcohol, because really, if we were to go by the data, none of us should be drinking. Alcohol is a massive killer of people, but there is no way like a British government is going to, especially maybe in this time of us all being quarantined, the lockdown, is going to say stop drinking, even though maybe we should. But you know, life is pretty bleak enough as it is. So yeah, no, it's a nice piece, a lot to it, covers a lot of ground. And as I said, it's kind of probing, because it's very fashionable to talk about governing by data. But, you know, what are the upsides and downsides of it and so on. Stephen's piece just briefly mentions the coronavirus, but it's not all about Corona at Computer Weekly. And before we move to a close today, I'd like to make mention of a development in the ongoing Post Office Horizon computer system story. So this week, the Criminal Cases Review Commission, the CCRC, announced they've decided to refer 39 appeals from postmasters to have their criminal convictions quashed by the Court of Appeal. Now, that's a Carl Flinders story. Carl, as we know, has been on the case with this since 2009. We can't really do it justice here, but I just wanted to flag that story and also flag Carl's gargantuan coverage. As I said, it's not all Corona here at Computer Weekly at the moment. Well, that's all we've got time for, I think, today. So we're going to take a 2-week break. We'll be back recording on the 17th of April, and the episode will drop on Tuesday, 21st of April. So on this occasion, it just remains for me to say thank you very much indeed to Caroline.
Thank you very much, and happy Easter, everybody.
That's right, we'll be back after Easter. And thank you very much indeed to Alex.
Thank you for having me again, guys.
Our pleasure. And thank you to you for listening. Okay. And take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.